Welcome to Cooper and Carey Have Words. My name is James Carey. I'm over here in the United Kingdom in the southwest corner in a county called Somerset. What county are you in, Barry, in Florida?
Volusia.
Oh.
Yeah. Famous for not many things, really, apart from, you know, the usual sort of alligators and high humidity.
Yeah.
But it's lovely to be here. And we're 4,000 miles away, but we try and make it work somehow. That's the kind of Cooper and Carey Have Words shtick, isn't it?
Yeah, that's it. And we like to get on with it. We don't waggle on the tee. We're going to welcome a sensational guest. And I've been listening to his podcast for quite some time now. So it's thrilling to be able to ask him direct questions and get answers. He is the host of the Novel Marketing Podcast and the Christian Publishing Show. He's a blogger, the CEO of Author Media, and he was homeschooled. Could there be a more perfect guest for Cooper and Carey than Thomas Umstead Jr.? Welcome to Cooper and Carey Have Words.
Thanks for having me. I'm excited to be here.
And he's written a book about dating as well. Let's not forget that. So he really is in the sweet spot for us.
Maybe we'll get onto that with our Patreons at the end. But why don't we just talk a bit about writing novels? And the big question of the episode and the reason why we're having this conversation is, should more Christians be writing novels? And I'm asking that question now because coming up in November is this NaNoWriMo, which is National Novel Writing Month of November. And so we'll get on to that in a moment. But I thought it'd be fun to have a think about, should Christians be writing novels? And of course, you spend a lot of time mentoring people and training people in how to write and promote novels. And you do that as a Christian, although you do that in the secular space. So are you frustrated that this is something that Christians aren't doing? Do you think Christians are afraid of novels? And is that changing? How do you see things at the moment?
I mean, from my perspective, there's a lot of Christians, at least here in the States, trying to write a novel. If you go to a Christian writers conference, there's hundreds and hundreds of aspiring novelists. The big ones are American fiction writers, and another one is Realm Makers. I'm blanking on the names, but there's some big conferences that will have 200 or 300, sometimes 500 novelists.
Yeah.
Realm Makers is just fantasy and science fiction, and it'll have 500 novelists there. So there's a lot of people trying, but trying to write a novel and changing the world with a novel are very different things.
Yeah, but I think... well, firstly, you've highlighted a big difference between the UK and the US, because in the UK, there aren't Christian bookshops anymore. There just aren't any. And regular bookshops, I was in one the other day. In fact, the one in my hometown called, and the branch of Waterstones, which is a big chain in the UK, has one shelf of Christian books. Not one set of shelves, one shelf of Christian books. Half of those are Bibles. And the other half are books telling you why you don't need to read the Bible because it's probably wrong. So there isn't a Christian publishing market in the UK, really. Whereas obviously, I guess that's a bit different in the States. Is that your experience too, Barry?
Yeah, I think so. There's definitely a bit more presence, but a lot of the books that qualify as Christian, e.g. the ones you have at the checkout at Walmart, you'd think they more fall in the category of positive thinking, I would say, than sort of properly Christian. But I don't know, Thomas, what do you think on that?
So many of the big Christian publishers were founded by very religious people. And over the last 20 years, many of them have been sold to one or other of the big five publishers. Actually, first, if I could, I want to give a little bit of history of where Christian publishing came from, because I suspect it's a little bit different across the pond. Hmm. So back in the 1950s, the Christians got pushed out of the secular bookstores and the secular publishing companies and even secular distribution. But instead of going quietly into that good night, we created our own completely parallel economy, where we had Christian publishers that were Christian owned. We had a Christian distribution. So the big distributor is not Ingram, it's Anchor. So here in the States, there's a distributor that distributes the books to the stores and to the places that's specifically Christian. So if someone's trying to cancel you for taking a strict line on the scriptures, there's no secular company for them to hit, because even the retailers are Christian owned all the way down, top to bottom. But then in the 90s, the Left Behind series came out. And the Left Behind series was so popular that every bookstore wanted to stock it, including Walmart. So there was a time in the 90s where there'd be big bins near the checkout at Walmart for you to get this it's a premillennial eschatology, I think is what it is, book, right? It's like not what you would think Walmart would be selling, but they were interested in the money because those books sold $1 billion worth of books total.
Whoa.
And it was a very successful series, fantastically successful series. And so what that triggered was people suddenly going to regular bookstores looking for Christian books. And that also started the wave of that first generation that started their publishing companies in the 50s, 60s, and 70s. They were starting to retire. And so they have two choices, right? You send your company down a generation, which is complicated and risky, or you sell your company to a big publisher who's offering you a fantastic amount of money. And so a lot of people are like, well, let's just sell to HarperCollins, or let's sell to Random House, or let's sell to one of the other big five. And the result was that a lot of the Christian bookstores got squeezed, because what would happen in the early days, someone would come into a Lifeway looking for a Left Behind book, and then they'd buy a bunch of other books as well, and it created this big halo. But if they're now being pulled somewhere else instead of to the Christian bookstore, a lot of the Christian bookstores got squeezed. And the Christian bookstores didn't do a good job embracing conservative Christianity. So I remember my mom being very frustrated with Lifeway, for instance, that it didn't have better support for homeschoolers. And there was kind of, at least she perceived in the 90s, a bias against homeschoolers. They didn't have any homeschool curriculum. And she didn't have the language that back then, but she would have considered it a woke store. And it's interesting, of the three, Family Christian Stores, Lifeway, and Mardell, the only one that's still around in the United States is Mardell, which is the one that was explicitly supporting of homeschooling. So you can go and buy homeschool curriculum at Mardell, and it's doing just fine as far as I know. They still have locations and they're still selling very well. Now, we've kind of come full circle now. Present day, most people buy most books on Amazon, and anyone can put a book in the Christian category on Amazon. And so Christians have more or less lost control, at least online, of the retail side of the picture. But I will say many Christian books are sold at these secret in-person gatherings called homeschool conventions, where hundreds of thousands or millions of dollars worth of books will be sold cash on the barrel, not tracked by MPD Group, not tracked by any of the big numbers. But I know authors who'll sell $10,000, $20,000, $30,000 worth of books over a weekend at a homeschool convention. And they're not just books for children. These are books for the parents as well, and books all kinds, fiction, nonfiction, educational, but also not educational, and often literally cash on the barrel, like cash is being exchanged for a book that was printed at an offset printer, completely not tracked by the big data gathering companies.
Wow. Yeah, there's a whole off-grid sort of system in place there, isn't there? I think I remember listening, you did an episode on that, particularly on the Christian Publishing Show, I think, about selling at homeschooling conferences. And I remember you saying that in some states, like I think it's Alaska, the state actually gives you money to educate your kids because they can't do it, because the people are so diffuse and spread out. So you've got people literally with money burning holes in their pockets, and self-published Christian authors just going, give me your money. It's over here. Here are 30 books. That must be quite a feeling, wasn't it?
That's right. And even in states where it's not subsidized by the government, homeschool parents will spend thousands and thousands of dollars on books. It's very much a book culture. And if you're wanting to curate the kind of cultural experiences that your children have, it's a lot easier for somebody who agrees with you theologically and has a similar worldview to write a book that's in line with your worldview than to, say, have a movie that's in line with your worldview. And the cost of making a good book is so much less than the cost of having a good film, right? It's the production costs are just higher with a movie, and so it's harder to get that quality there. But you can have an absolutely very good book. You know, that I interviewed an author, S.T. Smith, and he has sold 1 million copies of his books to conservatives completely independently. And it's, you know, about rabbits, but it has a conservative soul. And he'll go to homeschool conventions. And I went to a homeschool convention and I saw it, and there was a line for his table, and he had a double booth there, and he wasn't even there. He just had his team there selling books, and they were doing very, very well.
Not just rabbits, rabbits with swords.
That's
Come
right.
On.
Yeah. Battle
yeah.
rabbits.
No, I did. I read the first one of those to my kids. I came across that.
Just words. But good words. That's where ideas begin. Maybe you should listen to them.
In the UK particularly, which doesn't have this Christian market in the same way, the majority of Christians who may be considering writing a novel are probably thinking, I'm going to write a novel for the traditional published mainstream media rather than the Christian media. But I don't know. I mean, the hundreds of Christians writing books in the space at those conferences you're talking about, is the expectation that they are books by Christians for Christians, or are some of them hoping to kind of either cross over or explicitly going for the mainstream?
So S.D. Smith is very explicitly Christian. There are Christians who are trying to write secular books. So there's an author, Jonathan Yanez, who sold, again, a million copies of his book. He does, you know, military science fiction mostly, and he's a Christian, but he's not writing explicitly Christian books, right? His books are informed by his worldview, and he's, you know, trying to honor God with his writing, but he's not, you know, presenting the gospel, right? These space marines aren't like having a prayer before they drop down to the planet or what have you. I mean, maybe some of them are. I haven't read all of his books. And I think a little bit of that would be totally thematically appropriate, right? There's no atheists in foxholes, but his approach is a little bit different. And he's also doing it completely independently. The real profitable authors often are the ones who are choosing to go independent because they have access to the marketing data that they need to make effective marketing decisions. If you're with a small publishing house, this applies in the Christian world too, and they're not marketing your book, but they're not giving you the data to market your book effectively, you're basically doomed to fail. So you either need the data so you can do it effectively yourself, or somebody needs to be willing to commit tens of thousands of dollars to market your book on your behalf.
Listeners may be amazed that so far we've not talked about actually writing a book. But this doesn't seem surprising to me, because in a way, this is the reality of it. Is, do you want to write a book that anyone's going to read? And the answer for most people is yes. Because I think some people think, I just need to write the book. I want to write it for me. I just have a story to tell and I just want to get it out there. I think that's quite a small number of people. And the people who do say that, I think half of them may be fibbing as well. But I think that's what's really struck me, is the more you think about novel, because it's so hard to actually make proper money doing it and to be a profitable author, and you have to kind of almost decide not to write one book but to write eight books because of that accumulation of contacts. It's a great big campaign, isn't it? So the actual writing of a book itself is only really a part of it, isn't it?
It is, but it's the most important part. And there's
okay, let's get into that.
Yeah, because good marketing can't fix a bad book. Now, right, a good book can die in obscurity, right? It used to be 1,000 books were published every day on Amazon. Now it's 3,000 books are published every day. And with the AI writing tools that are coming out, that will probably quickly climb to 5,000, 6,000, maybe 10,000 new books every day, because more people are able to write more books with better tools, right? The AI writing tools are going to have the same, and are already having the same impact on writing productivity as the word processor. Now, are they making books better? No. Did the word processor make books better? No. Right? I don't feel like the books written with word processors are better than the books written on typewriters or written with Quill. But there's more of them. Right? The number of books published has gone way up. But there's a very important number or principle that you need to understand publishing. And in the secular literature for this principle, it's called the Matthew principle, from the book of Matthew in the Bible. So Jesus tells a parable of some servant. He tells this parable several different times. I think it's in all the Gospels. And you can tell he told it a lot because he would change the details, right? If you're ever a public speaker, you have to, you know, you keep telling the same story, you fiddle with the details. So, but the big brush is, a rich man leaves to go to a faraway place. And he leaves his money with his different stewards or his different servants. And he gives and they invest the money and see different rates of return. And then he rewards them disproportionately to their success, right? So the guy who buried his money gets cast out. And the man who invested it the most wisely is given the greatest reward. And the phrase at the end is, to him who has, more will be given, but to him who does not have, even what he thinks he has will be taken away. And what Jesus is describing here is something that economists refer to as the Pareto phenomenon. And so in the world, there's two statistical distributions that govern most things. We're familiar with the standard distribution, right? Height is like this, weight is like this. It's the classic bell curve that you've seen. But not everything is judged by the standard distribution. The other distribution is the Pareto distribution. This is the world of money. This is the world of spiritual things. This is also what governs the mass of celestial bodies, right? Because to him who has, more will be given. So if you're a planet and you have a lot of mass, you have more gravity, which causes you to pull more space dust and asteroids into your orbit, which then adds to your mass, which then gives you more gravity, which pulls in more stuff. And the same with stars and the same with money, right? The more money you have, the more money you can make. And the more spiritual power you have, right? Jesus gives a lot of metaphors about farming and 100-fold returns. And as people live in a democracy, we think, man, if we could just get enough people praying, right? It's like voting in the, you know, democracy of heaven. But that's not how the spiritual world works. One righteous man's prayer is powerful enough, right? Because it's about having the ear of the king. And it's, you know, lots of people praying is good. I don't want to knock that, but it's not a democracy. We're not voting for God to do something. And so publishing is governed. Publishing success is governed by this Pareto phenomenon. And you may have heard it referred to as the 80-20 principle, where 20% of the inputs result in 80% of the outputs. But that ratio of 20 to 80 isn't always the case. Sometimes it's 5% of the inputs result in 99% of the outputs. So yeah, it doesn't always add to 100.
Yeah. Podcasting is a very good example. I was trying to explain to someone the other day what podcasting numbers were, and the fact that, you know, we do okay in terms of our numbers mean we're in the top 5 to 10% of podcasts, and people would find that incredible because obviously no one's ever heard of us, even in the Christian world. But what that tells you is the 1% is Joe Rogan, and he gets absolutely millions of downloads, and thereafter it falls off really, really quickly. So, yeah, I think that, you know, within podcasting as well, that is a very, very firm law, isn't it? And that long tail gets really long and very taily very, very quickly.
You're actually in the top 1%. I just looked this up.
Now,
Joe Rogan's in the top 0.001%, right?
Okay, there yes. we go.
But this actually is a perfect illustration of this principle. Yeah. So podcasting is not 80-20. Joe Rogan gets more downloads in one day than 50% of podcasts ever get in the lifetime of their podcast.
Wow.
And it's very difficult to wrap our mind around the power of the Pareto distribution, right? We don't really understand how big the number billion is, right? Like, we can't conceive it, right? We throw around the word billion. Oh, so-and-so is a billionaire, but we don't actually know how much money that is. It's kind of the same with celestial things, right? You see this description of like, oh, the sun is 83 Earths wide or whatever the number is. And you're like, I have no idea how big that is, right? Just imagining how big the Earth is, is very hard. And it's very difficult to wrap your mind around this. And the result is that just one person with one successful book can change the whole world if they get on the right side of that Pareto curve, where it becomes a self-fulfilling prophecy, where people want to listen to your song because everyone else is listening to your song. They want to read your book because everyone else is reading your book. And so that's why the writing is so important, because if it's not written well enough, or people are recommending it for the book's sake, no marketing will get it to the right side of that self-fulfilling prophecy.
I mean, the most inspiring examples for Christians would be, you know, the Chronicles of Narnia, and would be the Lord of the Rings, who are just sort of two absolutely gigantic. And J.K. Rowling, I guess, is another sort of modern day equivalent.
Well, and what's fun is that Lewis and Tolkien represent the two different strategies. So Lewis was writing a Christian book with explicitly Christian messaging, whereas Tolkien was trying to restore the lost Anglo-Saxon mythology that was lost with the Norman invasion. So we knew what the Britons' mythology were. We knew what the Normans' mythology were. But the Saxons was lost to history. We don't really know what it was, but we do know their language. And so he kind of rebuilt the mythology from the language, from the names of the people, right? Because everybody in Anglo-Saxon had names like Alfred, right? Elf friend. So he's like, I'm going to make a world full of elves. And so, but he was a strong Christian, right? The Holy Spirit was in his heart, and it couldn't help but leak through his writing. And it's a Christian book in the sense of subtle worldview, and it's edifying. As a Christian, I read it, and I feel edified. I don't feel like I'm reading lies, even though it's very obviously fiction, right? But it's a very different experience from the Chronicles of Narnia. And it's interesting because Tolkien did not have a high view of Narnia. So if you pick up Lord of the Rings today, it's got a blurb on the cover still from C.S. Lewis saying, these are beauties that bite like cold iron, right? And he loved Middle Earth, and he loved Lord of the Rings. Tolkien could not stand Narnia. He thought it was too on the nose. He thought it was too preachy. And yet they've both stood the test of time, and they both still resonate with readers. My four-year-old loves Narnia. I'm reading them out loud to her, and she wants to have a silver chair-themed birthday party when she turns five.
Oh, wow. That's one of the coolest of the seven books as well. I would love it if they'd re-released the Chronicles of Narnia with the back blurb, which just has a quote from Tolkien that just goes, meh. Or Father Christmas in Narnia. I've never heard of anything so ridiculous. But I guess the temptation then is to think, I want to write a novel because I want to be as big as Tolkien, or I want to be as big as C.S. Lewis. And that is the way that I will influence the world. And of course, it's not the case that that they haven't done that. Of course they have. But there have got to be better reasons for doing it. I mean, Barry, what would cause you to actually want to write a novel? Obviously, you've read a lot of novels in your time, but the idea that you would be the next C.S. Lewis is, I mean, I'm not saying it's ridiculous, but it's not a good plan, because you're only going to set yourself up for failure, aren't you? If you go into podcasting, think you're the next Joe Rogan, and you don't reach those figures, you're going to be sad. But, you know, can you, what would make you want to write a novel?
I think it's got to be a fire in the bones, hasn't it? That you just can't shut up. You have to, you know, give an outlet to it. I've never had that. I know you're supposed to have a novel inside you. I think I'm quite good at the micro description of things, but the macro, the sort of building of plots and that kind of thing, is not something that I have in my locker. So therefore, I've never really been drawn to writing a novel. But I guess that's got to be it, isn't it? Something about it, a story that just has to tear its way out of you. I don't know.
I don't know. I mean, Thomas, when you are mentoring sort of writers, what are their motivations for writing a novel? And I guess there are good ones, and I guess there are probably bad reasons to write novels. I mean, like, to make money. I mean, that's a terrible reason to write a novel, isn't it?
That's actually a very uncommon reason I've noticed amongst authors.
Okay.
Often to my frustration, because it's like, okay. Because if your motivation is to make money, you start to bring the reader into it. Most people write because they have something you want to say. So that amongst Christians, all the other Christians are doing it wrong, and they need to be more like me and learn how to do it right. And I'm going to write the book, and I'm going to tell them all why they're doing it wrong and why they need to repent and be more like me. That's an uncharitable phrasing of it. That's never how they phrase it in their mind, right? They'll say, oh, there's this big problem in Christianity, and people need to, you know, pray more, or they need to forgive better, or whatever. And the challenge with that kind of book is that nobody wants to read a book telling them that they're wrong. Right? If you're a Democrat, you don't want to read a book by a Republican about how bad and evil the Democrats are, and vice versa, right? That kind of book doesn't sell. And that's the other motivation, is I want to write a book and it's going to bring all these people to Christ, which is an admirable goal, right? That's a very admirable goal. But to be successful in that, you need to be already doing that in real life, right? If you're not talking to unbelievers in real life and sharing the gospel with them, how can you expect to do on the page what you can't do in real life, right? The book has to be, has to come out of how you're living your life, and you have to kind of earn the credibility and know that what you're talking about is resonant, right? That it connects with people, right? If your arguments work or not, right? Do people find your arguments convincing, or do they not find them convincing? The only way to find that out is to actually, in the real world, interact with your readers.
It's interesting, isn't it? Tim Keller, I think, said that he didn't want to publish anything before he was, I think it was 50. And that it was for that reason. He just felt like I need to sort of have the experience and as it were, workshop the conversations and the arguments before you can write anything that has that kind of resonance to it. And I think that is something that where platforms feel like they're relatively easily come by in a world of social media, that can be a danger, can't it? Because you can sort of think, well, you know, there's a few people listen to me on Twitter. I'm 26 years old. Let me tell you how to bring up kids, or let me tell you how to, you know, evangelize non-believers. It's just, it doesn't quite ring true.
That's true. But I think there's something about the arrogance of youth that I think God uses in a particular way. So, you know, I went to university, I studied theology, but I, you know, spent most of my time writing comedy sketches. And then I pretty quickly wrote a sitcom for BBC Radio 4. And I'm looking back just thinking, age 23, I thought I could write a sitcom for the radio that are like a million people listen to. What was I thinking? And fun fact, this isn't self-aggrandizing, although it is, it won a Sony Silver Radio Award. You know, the first thing I did for BBC Radio 4 was an award-winning sitcom. I came second to a compilation episode of I'm Sorry, I Haven't a Clue, which is like a brilliantly well-reviewed popular radio show. So I had that. And I look back and I'm learning so much about sitcom writing now that I'm literally over twice the age of 23, and just thinking how much I'm learning and just thinking, how did I have a successful sitcom writing career when I didn't know that sitcoms are about the relationships between the characters, not just the characters themselves, you know? And so I think there's something in that arrogance of youth that you think you can do it, which I think is quite a good, healthy thing. But actually there's an element of like, just write the first novel. No one cares. No one's going to read it. And then move on. But let's just talk a bit about writing a novel itself. And I think one thing, again, about the actual decision of what to write as well. The thing, again, that comes across in all of the novel writing bits of advice and your podcast, but also many others, is leaning into genre. And I think that's something, again, that maybe people have a hard time thinking, because they just want to write the novel that they want to write rather than thinking about writing a book that someone actually wants to read. And I think that is always a really bit of powerful advice that comes across. And actually the genre is your friend, isn't it? And there are sub-genres and niche sub-genres, and actually that's a good thing. That almost gives you a good place to start, because you don't need to reinvent the wheel or write the great American novel from scratch. You know, you write a novel that's like novels that you like reading. Maybe
there are tens of millions of books out there, and the idea of competing with all of them is very overwhelming. But you're not. You're only competing, really, with the other books on your shelf in the bookstore or in your category on Amazon. And so the narrower your category, the less competition you have and the easier it is to thrill your target reader. And I have kind of a cheat code on how to do this well. And it's also from the Bible, actually. So I call it finding your Timothy. So in radio or in business, you would have this exercise of creating a customer avatar, which is a fictional representation of your target listener or your target customer. And I found that for authors, that exercise, which is very helpful in corporate America, is almost useless, because they end up just describing themselves in generic terms. And they're so creative that their imaginary friend loves everything they do, and it doesn't help them make better decisions, better writing decisions, or better marketing decisions, which is what that whole exercise in corporate America is for. And so what I've started recommending for authors, and we've seen some really great success with this, and successful authors have been doing this for centuries. So I didn't invent this. In fact, that's where the term comes from. Timothy was an actual guy that the book of Timothy in the Bible, or the books of Timothy in the Bible, were written to. And you're like, but it was just written to one person. Won't that ruin its appeal? No, it makes it more understandable. It makes it more approachable. In fact, most of the New Testament was written to either a specific person, both Luke and Acts were written to a specific person, or to a very specific group of people. And if you don't believe me, just take a random epistle and flip to the last chapter and read all the names. So knowing your target reader and an actual target person, a human being that you can take out to coffee, who's a fan of your genre. So if you're writing contemporary romance, find somebody who reads contemporary romance, take her out to coffee and ask her questions about the books that she's reading. Read the books that she's reading. Get familiar with that genre. And if you can thrill her, that actual human person, you can thrill many more. And if you can't thrill her, you can't thrill anyone.
Again, as you were saying, if you want to write romantic fiction, and I guess one of the problems is people going, yeah, but my book isn't that. It's kind of romantic fiction, but it's also magical. But it's also set in the past, and there's a whole time travel element as well. To which,
warning, you know, warning.
Yeah, mayday, mayday.
Don't put ketchup on your ice cream because you like ketchup.
Yeah, yeah. And so I guess focusing your idea is really hard, isn't it? And so the actual craft of just being clear, and you know, and the other thing I pick up is there are two schools of there are planners and then the pantsers who write a draft by the seat of their pants, and then they'll go back and kind of bash it into shape and do much more editing. And it kind of doesn't matter which one you do. You're essentially planning it either properly or planning it by sketching it and then reshaping it. But I don't know, is any one particular method more common than the other in your experience?
You'll find very successful authors who use both discovery writing, which I've learned is the more politically correct term than pantsing, because people don't even know that term. They hear it for the first time and they're a little taken aback by it. But writing by the seat of your pants and writing from a good outline, they both work. And they're neither one of them is necessarily easier, although I lean towards, I think outlining may be easier for more people, partly because to outline, you have to understand story structure. You need to understand either the hero's journey or the three-act structure, some kind of structure that you're building your outline from. And if you can't put together an outline, it is a good indication that you haven't studied craft enough to understand what makes a novel work. And so your ignorance becomes more obvious. Whereas if somebody's discovering writing, they can keep working on a book and it's just not working and they don't know why it's not working. And what they really need to do is put that book aside and go read some books on writing books, because there's a lot of really great books on story writing. And you know, this is a craft that we mastered thousands of years ago, and it's been passed down from the generations, and the craft is in good hands, right? It's taught well. And you just need to get access to that teaching. And ultimately, whether you're discovery writing or outlining, you need to understand good story structure, good characterization, good dialogue, how to handle curiosity in the mind of the reader, how to handle tension in the mind of the reader, knowing who your reader is and what they're looking for in a story. And as you invest in learning these things, the book will start to come together in a more holistic and appealing way to that target reader.
How you coming on that novel you're working on? Got a nice little story you're working on there? A big novel? Got a compelling protagonist? Yeah, got an obstacle for him to overcome? Huh? Nice little narrative, beginning, middle, and end? Some friends become enemies, some enemies become friends? Yeah? At the end, your main character is richer for the experience? Yeah? Yeah, you got that? No, you deserve some time off.
Thomas, this may be a sidebar, but just listening to you talking then, do you think this is something that preachers ought to study?
Good storytelling was used quite a bit by a very famous preacher 2,000 years ago by the name of Jesus Christ. And
yes, good answer.
And often stories, sermon illustrations are not told well. The most common mistake I see pastors make is they say, let me tell you about the time I cracked my head open and what I learned from that. And it's like, oh, you just gave away the ending. I know TV show writers can sometimes get away with it, but even in TV shows, it's rarely better. It's just a way for screenwriters to flex to other screenwriters. It's like, tell the beginning, make people curious, right? Pull them through the story, you know, and don't give away the ending until the ending. And it's so much more powerful that way, because the story is what people remember. It's what sticks with them, and it is very powerful. You know, if God had tasked me with writing the Bible, I'd have been like, okay, Genesis 1:1, the Ten Commandments. But that's not what he did, right? The whole first book of the Bible is one big long narrative. There's no preaching there's no, you know, this is how to live your life. In that whole book, there's a little here and there, but it's all couched in dialogue with characters. It's a story. And then it's like, okay, fine, introductory story, get to Exodus. Now hit me with them 10 commandments. And what do you get? 20 more chapters of narrative. So yes, eventually you get the 10 commandments and the law, and then you get more narrative, and then you get commentary on that narrative. And I think that that structure is a really good structure, right? The Bible has proved the test of time. And don't try to think, oh, I don't need to follow those rules. I can just open with the Ten Commandments. I can just tell people how they're going to live, and it's going to stick with them. That's a pretty ambitious. That's pretty prideful, right? That storytelling
turns
is
out
very
God important. Is quite good at structure.
Who knew? Would you recommend people lean into the writing a novel in November, or do you think that's a distraction? I mean, the idea of trying to write a novel in a month to me sounds absurd. Although, having said that, I've got a sort of a TV idea that I think would make quite a good novel. I've actually got 6 episodes kind of sketched out, and it's a story I really, really want to tell. And I can imagine writing 1,500 words a day for a month, and that would pretty much break the back of it. But I'm a long way down the track on that, and I've got the characters, and so I sort of know. But a standing start writing a novel in a month, I mean, that's just typing, isn't it? That's the worry.
I'm a big fan of NaNoWriMo. To write a book, you need 3 things. You need skill, you need discipline, and you need hard work. And
there's a 4th one that's called coffee. Come on.
lots and lots of coffee. And yeah. NaNoWriMo helps really a lot with the hard work and the discipline. And having a pace that you're keeping with everyone else is really good for changing you, because the carpenter doesn't just build the house builds the carpenter, and you become a better carpenter having built a house. You become a better writer having written a book. And in the United States, right at the give up moment of the month of November, at the very most difficult point, right, the marathon, you know, the mile when everyone's going to give up, we have a major holiday called Thanksgiving. So it really like shakes loose. Am I the kind of person who's still going to write my 1,600 words on the morning of Thanksgiving? Am I the kind of person who's going to write 1,600 words the day after Thanksgiving, the day after I ate 10,000 calories in a 4-hour period? It's like that really changes you. If you're the kind of person who can write those words with a food hangover, suddenly all of the other distractions throughout the whole rest of the year aren't quite as intimidating. You're like, well, gosh, I was able to do NaNoWriMo and it had Thanksgiving right at the hardest point, right? Not at the beginning when you're all fired up. No, Thanksgiving comes at the end of the month when you're tired, you're already behind on your word count, you're ready to give up. And now Thanksgiving's coming and punching you in the face. And I know authors who will specifically do NaNoWriMo on any other month of the year just to avoid that Thanksgiving speed bump towards the end of the month.
Well, I mean, UK authors have got no excuse because we don't have Thanksgiving. So we just have that November weekend. When is it? It's the 3rd, 4th weekend in November or something?
Yeah, I think it's the 3rd. I don't remember the rule. It's always a weekend, though, so the date shifts around depending on what the structure of the month.
But it's not as wildly erratic as Easter, which is just extraordinary in its range. But yeah, I think a lot of people respond to a deadline. I think a lot of people respond to, I'm doing this along with other people. It doesn't make me feel so lonely. I mean, the actual website itself, I just kind of had a look, and you can kind of join and do it with, you know, and they'll kind of send you messages or bits of advice, and there's lots of advice on there. So you can actually, do people do that? Do they really lean in and sign up for it and it becomes a thing that we're all, I mean, in a way you're competing with everybody else, but I guess most people aren't even going to finish it. And those who do don't even send it to anyone because they kind of suddenly think this is terrible what I've written. But that's the thing I was going to say, actually, as I was thinking about this podcast in advance. If we think, do we think it would be better if more Christians wrote novels? I'd argue that we want Christians to write good novels. And you can't write a good novel until you've written a bad one.
It's like taking a shower. You turn on the hot water and at first cold water comes out. You just got to let the cold water flow. You just got to let the words flow. There are good words back in the pipes, but you got to get the bad words out of the way. And a lot of aspiring writers will go into the shower, they'll turn on the hot water, they'll experience the cold water, and then they'll say, oh, this is no good. And then they'll try again, you know, later, and it's still cold. And they never are willing to put up with the deluge of the cold water to get to the warm water. And so it does require that persistence. And I will say another advantage of writing a novel, even if you just write the one, right? You just do a NaNoWriMo and you don't end up publishing it. You will appreciate novels and good writing so much more. And it will expand your understanding and your, and I will say the more you study craft and the more you try to write a novel, it will ruin you for bad writing. You'll start to find that your taste is developing. You have a more sophisticated taste and you start to notice, oh, this movie that I didn't like, now I understand why I didn't like it, right? It's got a passive protagonist, and I dislike this protagonist because the protagonist isn't protagonist. He's not making any decisions to move the plot forward. No wonder I was rooting for the villain.
Okay. Yeah. Yeah, no, I think that's another good, it's another good reason to do it. And I guess, well, why not? You know, what else are you doing? Maybe you could, rather than scroll through social media for a month, you could write something. You know, there are so many other things. I know we're all really busy, but that you know, maybe don't watch Netflix for a month. Maybe cancel your subscription and instead write a novel. You know, I think for some, you might need to stop doing something else in order to do this. And I've got a sitcom writing course that's available. And I think in a way that's a different proposition because A, you've got to really love sitcoms, but B, what you're writing isn't the thing that people are going to read. A sitcom is a sitcom script is a architect's plans for a finished article, and so in a way that's a slightly different proposition. But the thing I do say at the beginning is, for a month, tell the people that you live with that you're going to do this, and that it really matters to you. And so, would they mind walking the dog so that you can do this? Would they mind emptying the dishwasher so that you can do this, you know, just for a month? And then you've got kind of people who are, and then you kind of have to do it. And, you know, once your other half has decided that they're going to do the 7 p.m. dog walk and you have to be writing, you better be writing. You know, you better be sitting there typing out some words. So I think, you know, making a pact with someone. My sister also recommended, I don't know if it says more about her than anything else. Hello, Alison, if you're listening. But she said, one way is to also make a pact that if you don't do it, you will make a donation to a charity that you dislike. So if I don't get this novel done, I'm going to give £100 to a cat rescue charity. And I hate cats. I don't want to help the cats. Whatever gets you there, it doesn't matter. Just finish it and then see what you've got. That would be one of my kind of bits of advice.
Cooper and Carey are being very productive.
There's a great camaraderie to NaNoWriMo since there's thousands or hundreds of thousands of other authors doing this. I know in my town, there's a meetup group called Sit Down, Shut Up and Write. And during NaNoWriMo, they meet every day at a coffee shop. And there's, and I've never been to a meeting, but I think there's 15 minutes of chit chat. And then they ring a bell. And for an hour, everyone is on their laptops and they are sitting and they're writing and doing nothing else. And then at the end of the hour, they ding the bell and everyone chit chats for 15 more minutes. And it's an hour and a half meeting. And everyone gets to sit down, shut up, and write. So there's a lot of ways to make this fun, you know, get an accountability partner, but give it a shot because. Right? The swiftest runner doesn't always win the race, and you could get lucky, right? That story that you're writing really could sing to the hearts of the people that you're writing to, and it could be the book that takes off.
Yeah. Last question before we might just record a bit more for our Patreons, if that's okay with you. But the last question for this then is, let's say you've written 70,000 words and you're kind of happy with it. What do you do then? What do you do with it? Who do you send it to? Is there a chance of getting it published? What would you do next?
Well, the next thing I do is subscribe to the Christian Publishing Show, because that's the point that you're at right now is exactly the point we have a lot of episodes on. So we just did an episode with Angela Hunt on revision. We walked through her six phases of self-revising. But let's say you've already revised it, you've got it edited, and you're ready to pitch it to agents and publishers if you want to go traditional publishing. We have episodes on all of those steps and how that dance works, of the mating dance of the authors and the agents and how to find a good agent for you and how to be attractive to an agent and ultimately how to get a publishing deal. And we also talk a lot about going independent. That's a whole conversation of the pros and cons. There are advantages of going traditional, especially for nonfiction or if paper is a big part of your strategy. Very simply, traditional books make most of their money with the paper book, and they don't make a lot of money with the ebook. And indie authors are the photo negative of that. They make very little money with the paper book, and they make most of their money with the ebook. And because of that difference, it shifts around. Some books and some genres work better for ebook because the target readership have Kindles, and others don't work as well. And in general, the older someone is, the more likely they are to own a Kindle. And the younger somebody is, the more likely they are to prefer paper and prefer hardback. So if you're writing for teenagers, your book really needs to be hardback. If you're writing for 60-year-olds, ebook is probably fine. But these are generalizations.
This is like, are you crazy? Kids are on their screens, aren't they? They're not reading Kindles. They want a hardback book. What is going on?
Yeah, you have to spend some time with your target reader to get to know them. So a Kindle is a purchase that requires discretionary income, and its killer feature, its absolute number one killer feature, is the ability to dynamically change the font size, which someone with young eyes doesn't care about. But somebody with old eyes loves that larger font size, and they don't mind paying that extra money for the e-reader. So yes, young people will read on a cell phone, but that's not an enjoyable reading experience. That's eye fatiguing. And if on the phone, you're competing with all of the other things to do on the phone that are probably more interesting than your book, right? There's TikTok, there's Facebook, there's, you know, all the games. So there's YouTube. So it's difficult to win in that phone environment. Some young people do, and there's online worlds where they're writing for each other and websites that publish that. But in general, and again, this is a generalization, but younger people want that hardback.
You were right to mention the Christian Publishing Show. I also highly recommend the Novel Marketing Podcast. Also, folks can go to authormedia.com, which is your website. Do you want to just say a little bit about, because you do courses and things like that too, and you kind of sort of mentor people. Do you want to just give us a 30-second pitch on that?
So authormedia.com is the home for the Novel Marketing Podcast, which is free. It's the longest running book marketing podcast in the world. We've been helping people with book marketing for almost 10 years now. So we're coming up on our 10-year anniversary this year. And we also have courses on book marketing and book promotion. And we also have a course on taxes and business. So if you're farther along on your journey and you're wanting to have questions about LLCs and taxation, only for America, I'm afraid. But if you're in the States or you're wanting to create a U.S. entity to receive your U.S. funds, if you're making a lot of sales here, we have a course to help you with that. But yes, if you're wanting to sell more books or build a bigger platform so that you can sell more books, we have courses for various aspects of that. So if you want to start a podcast, we have a course on that. If you want to start blogging, we have a course on that. If you want to grow your email list and quickly get your list into the thousands, we have a course that will show you how to do that.
Start a podcast and you could become as successful as Cooper and Carey Have Words and be in the top 1%. And every time you mention it to somebody else, they've never heard of it. That could be you if you start a podcast. But write a book, I reckon. Give a novel a crack, especially if you've never done that before. We're going to have a bit more of a chat over on Patreon and for our Cooper and Carey Plus listeners. But for now, Thomas, thank you so much for being with us. It's been great and surprising. All the things that don't seem important are important. Kindles. The kids aren't using Kindles, and here's why. Oh,
it's,
man.
It's fascinating. Thanks, Thomas.
Thanks, Thomas.
Thanks for having me.
Speak to you next time. Cheerio.
Y'all do an edit afterwards, right? So I can pause and look stuff up.
Yeah. No, I'll make you sound silky smooth.